Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. Today we have on Melanie George, who curated our brand new exhibition, Amplified Dignity, Black Dancers Drawn by Hirschfeld. As always, please follow along with this exhibition. There's a link in the show notes. And if you're viewing the exhibition while we're talking about it, it's going to be a better experience for everyone. So scroll down right now, click on the exhibition link, and follow along so you can see exactly what we're talking about. We had a very enlightening conversation with her about the new exhibition, and we hope you enjoy it. Before we start the conversation, I just wanted to remind you to follow us on Facebook, the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, Twitter and Instagram, at Al Hirschfeld. You can find the podcast at alhirschfeldfoundation.org/podcasts with an S at the end. S is for Stompin' at the Savoy, which you'll hear about in our conversation. And don't forget to check out our shop, alhirschfeldfoundationshop.org. where you can find merchandise from this exhibition and a lot of our previous exhibitions, as well as the largest collection of limited edition Hirschfeld etchings and lithographs. Without further ado, we'll play the conversation.
Today we have Melanie George on the podcast. Melanie is a dance educator, a choreographer, a dramaturg, and a scholar. She is the founder and director of Jazz Is, a dance project, and an associate curator at Jacob's Pillow. If you want to know more about the many, many things that Melanie does, you should go to her website, melaniegeorge.org. You can also find her on Instagram at Jazz Dance Direct. You can find her on Twitter at Jazzy Dramaturg, and on Facebook under Jazz Is ...Dance Project. Welcome, Melanie, and thank you for coming on the podcast, and more importantly, for curating our new exhibition, Amplified Dignity, Black Dancers Drawn by Hirschfeld.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. The Amplified Dignity exhibition is part of a series of exhibitions we started last summer about Black arts. The first exhibition was about Black theater. This show is about Black dance. And later this year, we'll be doing shows on Black film and Black music. And at the end of the year, we'll do a special 80th anniversary exhibition and podcast about Hirschfeld's Harlem as Seen by Hirschfeld, a collection of lithographs that he did of Harlem in 1941. So, Melanie, tell us about the Amplified Dignity show that you put together.
Well, I was given sort of the free rein to look at all of the images that were available, and I went with the images that I found the most engaging, and then sort of looked for the story that was within those images, and so. For me, that meant having to do some research on the role of caricature and how to situate Black artists, particularly ones depicted in a pre-Civil Rights America, how to situate that art. It meant having to do some research around Hirschfeld and what his politics were.
Sure.
And out of that, you know, being a fan of all of the people who are depicted within the images, the thing that jumped out to me was that, you know, these are people who've had really, really, really long careers and were, you know, journey people, as opposed to saying journeymen. They were journey people in the arts. And regardless of what production that they're involved in or how they were captured, or even the images that are sort of more abstract and not depicting any person in particular that we can name, that to me it's this sense of being very grounded in a sense of history and lineage within dance and in diaspora. So someone like the Nicholas brothers, who are two of the greatest tap dancers that have ever walked the face of the earth, And though they are successful by the standards of the artists who were their peers, their success had a ceiling to it.
Right.
And there is a dignity around being the very best with the ceiling, you know, that is not of your own making.
Right.
So that's sort of where the idea of the title came from for me.
Sure.
A mix of where these artists are situated in history and what it means to be depicted in caricature, which is also this sense of amplification.
Right. Everybody has to know you for the caricature to be successful.
Right.
And I think the Nicholas Brothers, perfect example. They were well known in their field at that time. I mean, as you write, they were Fred Astaire's favorite tap dancers. So I think their peers, no matter what color they might have been, recognized their brilliance. And it's just really unfortunate they never got the public acceptance because of the time period that they deserved.
It's interesting. I think that the clips of the Nicholas Brothers are some of the most circulated on the internet in terms of when tap dance comes around in blogs and in, you know, on Facebook and all of those things. And so it isn't that people don't recognize it.
Sure.
And to be quite frank with you, I feel like it's not enough to say that it's unfortunate. It was strategic and systemic. And so they're victims of a society that found them useful but not valuable.
Right.
And that is beyond problematic. It is, you know, the nature of how the arts function in our history. The other thing I'll just say is that being that Hirschfeld, you know, is an American artist who depicted American artists, there's no way that you could possibly catalog dance in America or music in America or theater in America. But since I'm a dancer,
right,
I'll talk about that. There's no way you can catalog the evolution of dance in America and not look at the contribution of Black dancers. It's just simply impossible.
Agreed.
So, you know, I threw in that tidbit about, you know, the sort of like, did you know that the Nicholas Brothers are Fred Astaire's favorite dancers? But it also sort of, in a way, for me, it rankles that I have to sort of qualify
right
their art by giving them that designation, that this, you know, this most successful white artist, he was their favorite, you know.
Right.
Unfortunately, the way that history functions is that it's not been enough to just you know, they were the best of the best, you know.
One of the reasons we want to do these series of exhibition is to use the power of Hirschfeld to help people to understand so many of these performers who they may not know, or maybe they've seen and don't know enough about. And that's what's so great when I read the text of the show. For a lot of these drawings, I knew who the people were, but I learned a great deal about really what they did and much more about who they were. So I think for anybody who's maybe even seen some of these drawings before, it's going to be a revelation. So thank you for that. Well, let's start, you know, when we talk about, you know, the history of dance, I think maybe one of the earliest dances in the show is the cakewalk.
Sure.
You know, why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, when you say cakewalk in the Hirschfeld world, there's a wonderful print that he did in 1970 of two Black figures in red, white, and blue costumes doing the cakewalk. And you chose a wonderful one, the cakewalk scene from St. Louis Woman. A little history on the cakewalk would be wonderful.
Sure. So the cakewalk is this amazing representation of the politics and curiosities of race relations in America. And it stems from plantation owners who had enslaved people, observing them doing an imitation of them. So this is a thing that they didn't know initially, that these Black dancers had made up a dance that was meant to satirized the way that they were seeing the mannerisms of these white plantation owners. And then, as is the way of cultural appropriation, they looked at this dance and started and first had the dancers, the enslaved peoples, do this dance as competition for their entertainment. And so they would pit them against each other. And the origin of the name is that the winner would get a cake of some sort. And then the white owners are so enamored with that kind of dancing, that style of dancing, that they begin to adopt it themselves. And so it's this odd mix that can be, you can find other versions of this story over time with dance, where there's this originated here and was taken there and now became something else and may have been repurposed. So the actual cakewalk itself, you know, unlike the roots of a lot of West African dance, which is what we know to be the roots of jazz, and the cakewalk is considered an early jazz dance in mm-hmm. America. The cakewalk itself is sort of has a more of an upright, erect spine, whereas we know the roots of jazz tend to have a much more rounded spine and you tend to be lower to the ground. And so embedded in the actual dancing itself, you see this, the way that the African aesthetics are bumping up against the Eurocentric aesthetics within the work.
Wow. So in a sense, when Hirschfeld draws it, he's caricaturing a caricature, because I mean, that's what it was set out to be.
Caricature that was actually a caricature, because right. the nature of the performance of these kinds of dances or theater or comedy or music is that all of this stuff is grounded in minstrelsy, right? And yeah. and minstrelsy was purposely meant to be satirized caricatures, exploitation of perceived negative depictions of Black people. And so it, like, the layers,
yeah, that's right,
is really all of American history in terms of race relations,
you know? Right. I mean, that's so often American history is all these layers, and especially when it comes to race. Well, one of the wonderful pieces that you pick for this show is an image of Josephine Baker that I don't think many people know. There's a very well-known drawing that Hirschfeld did of her in 1964 when she came back to America and did a special engagement on Broadway. But this is from the Ziegfeld Follies in the 1930s. And you write very eloquently about this piece and who she is. And could you fill us in on that?
Sure. I was really moved by this image because, as I say in the caption that accompanies the image, most depictions of Josephine Baker are, you know, are a little bit more salacious, and they depict her as, you know, in a sort of her most wild and sensual. And that isn't that wasn't who she was on stage.
But sure.
We know that people have many layers of humanity, and that's just one version of who she was. And so instead of, you know, Josephine Baker in the banana skirt, this is her just purely singing in a gown. And right. and it humanized her in a way that I so rarely see her humanized in drawings. It made her the subject, not the object.
Right.
And, so this particular event, I believe it was 1936.
Right.
Been invited to join a sort of remounting of a Ziegfeld Follies production. They were reconceiving it and trying to update it, and she was invited to do this. And I think, from what I can tell from the research that I found, it seems that she didn't do a lot of the sort of wildness that people were used to. And she was doing a lot of singing, and she had, just prior to that performance, she had done another show somewhere in Europe where she'd done a lot of operatic training. And so I think my sense is that there was some of that kind of singing, and I think, frankly, that people were not expecting that from the wild Black woman who right. was singing, used to sing, you know, in the banana skirt. And it wasn't well received. The review used some slurs in regard to her, and shortly after, she returned to France and renounced her American citizenship.
Wow!
Yeah, and so it captures her in this time, and she looks so simultaneously youthful and vulnerable, and yet brave right. in that particular image. That I was really moved by it.
Yeah, it has a very ethereal quality to it as well. I mean, I'm fascinated just when I look at it. We only have a reproduction of the newspaper clipping, the drawing. I wish I knew where it was.
We didn't actually know about this drawing. And I was going through the microfilms at the New York Public Library Performing Arts, and it was came out of nowhere. And I said, oh my gosh, we don't even know about this drawing. So unfortunately, that's the only reproduction we have of it, but I'm so glad we found it at all.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. It sort of stands to reason in a way, though, because aside from, you know, what I know to be your extensive archival practices, as a performance, because it was so not well regarded, I'm not surprised that, like, the accompanying imagery that exists also just sort of fades away, you know?
Right, right.
It's one of the harder things, I think, about being a historian, is trying to keep track of things that people didn't necessarily value during the time that they existed.
Precisely. Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Hirschfeld had seen her in Paris in the 1920s. He spent a considerable amount of time there. And a review that featured hot jazz would have been catnip for him. Mm. We know in 1928, he goes to see Buster West and Noble Sissle leading a band.
Oh, yeah.
I think included Sidney Bechet, and you know, it's a fabulous time. He's waiting in Paris before he's going to Russia for his honeymoon, and that's the drawing he sends back from Paris. So I'm sure he was in those clubs, and I'm sure he was familiar, and of course he would have known the posters, of course, of Baker, the Paul Cologne posters, which would have been something he would have been very attracted to.
Yeah. Well, let me also say that when I make the point about the distinction between that Hirschfeld image and these sort of more famous, more frequently reproduced images, I love those images too. I have one of them in my spare bedroom right now. Yeah. So it isn't that I, you know, I'm trying to erase that part of, I couldn't erase it if I tried.
But, no. Yeah, right.
But I love the idea of part of the representation of dignity is also allowing these Black artists to be their full selves and not be boxed in.
Yeah.
Right. And so I want to talk about two other tap dancers, because I know you really know so much about all kinds of dance, but tap dance as well. Bunny Briggs and Honey Coles.
Just two of the greatest tap dancers who just ever. Like, I love Honey Coles so much. I can't. When I was a young person, I had a crush on him, and this man was like, I'll start by talking about Honey Coles in terms of Coles and Atkins. And so he was part of this very famous duo called Coles and Atkins, which was him, Charles Honey Coles, and his partner, who's Charles Cholly Atkins. And most people are probably more, they may not know it, but they're probably more familiar with the work of Atkins. Because after, I'm going to give a little bit of extra history here just to contextualize it.
No, please.
So tap dance was the popular dancing that you saw in American musical theater for a very, very long time. And there was also a whole circuit of nightclubs that tap dancers toured with jazz combos, and they had whole careers around this. Mm-hmm. And for a variety of reasons, one of which is that Agnes DeMille made Oklahoma, and all of a sudden ballet began to be the thing that we saw in musical theater more than tap. Mm-hmm. Along with that, and just sort of changing tides and theater, meant that tap dancers began to not have as much work available to them as they had towards the 1950s, and pretty much for like a solid 20 to 25 years. And so after, when that was happening, these guys had to go find other jobs, like, you know, jobs. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say just, because it's, you know, it's amazing, but they couldn't be exclusively artists, you know, working artists. And so Honey Coles ends up getting a job as the production manager at the Apollo Theater. And Cholly Atkins becomes the choreographer for Motown. So all of those signature dance steps that you see in from the Temptations and the Supremes and...
Wow.
And that's all Honey Coles. And so a lot of people are actually exposed to him. But also Cholly Atkins was at, you know, one of the most famous theaters for Black dancers ever when he wasn't performing himself. And so they were what's called a class act. which speaks to the sort of smoothness and elegance of their style. They always wore suits. Class acts always wore suits when they performed. But also, it's a little bit of a dog whistle to say, like, these are acceptable, either these are the acceptable kinds of black artists that you want,
Right.
as opposed to like the sort of down and dirty hoofers. And they could also do the down and dirty hoofing too, but the sort of marketing of them in that way was also strategic and has, you know, elements of racism embedded in that. And so just two of the most like crystal clear tappers and so smooth and charming and handsome. And I remember the first time I saw them dance, I was like, oh, I'm in love with these men who were my grandmother's age. So what happens in the 70s is there's this resurgence of an interest in tap dance, due in no small part to the success of Gregory Hines having a career.
And I guess my question is, did they learn, did Gregory Hines learn from them?
Yeah, because that's the way tap works, is that,
Right.
you know, it is as much an oral as it is a physical tradition. And so all of the masters studied with the masters before them, you know. And
Right.
Gregory Hines was, just to be on a little bit of a tangent, he was a master in his ability to sort of like really dig into what a particular master style was and be able to reproduce it. I don't want to say mimic, because I think mimic diminishes the skill that he had in doing that.
Right.
And so he could show you like Honey Cole's dances like this, and then he could say like Bunny Briggs dances like this, you know.
Oh.
And in turn, you know, in the way that Gregory Hines studied with all of those masters before him, Savion Glover studied with Gregory Hines and all of them,
Right.
you know. So like there's this long, it's a family, it's a community, and it still very much functions that way. And that is very much an Africanist way of imparting and sharing an art form. So Bunny Briggs is he's an interpreter, and he's masterful for his ability to be virtuosic and be like hyper rhythmic and detailed and always super musical, but then also give you some sort of flourish on the top of the dancing. I actually, blessedly, because of YouTube, by you know, I look
Yeah.
technology is
No,
so
we
wonderful.
all feel that way.
The image that Hirschfeld depicts, which is Bunny Briggs doing this solo, is on YouTube. You can watch it. And so,
Oh,
yeah,
we may link to that
Black
then.
and
Yeah.
Blue was recorded for PBS. So,
Right.
and you know, people just throw anything up on YouTube these days. And so someone recorded it off of their television and then shared it on PBS, shared it on YouTube, and you can actually watch it. And he does this incredible interpretation of In a Sentimental Mood, a Duke Ellington song. Briggs was known as, he toured for a long time with Duke Ellington's orchestra, and he was known as Duke's dancer. In Black and Blue, which is this homage to the music of Duke Ellington, with these amazing tap dancers and singers, and there's a few shows that are like this. There's, you know, Sophisticated Ladies in 81,
Right.
and so
Uptown It's Hot, which is
yeah,
not just.
when you look at the roster of artists on these shows, it's incredible. Like the deck is stacked so high with talent. And this Bunny Briggs solo, I must have watched it like 15 times. Like it's just he I know that particular tune very, very well, and he made me listen to the song differently because of the way that he does this solo. It's just such a different take on the way most people interact with that piece of music as something to dance to. It's really brilliant, brilliant.
And I want to just ask a little bit. He was Duke's dancer. I didn't realize that when Ellington toured, I always just assumed he had the big band and he had singers, but there were also dancers included in that show.
Yeah, so that was pretty typical, because the thing of it is, you know, in the n so tap and Lindy Hop are overlapping in terms of, I mean, tap actually precedes Lindy Hop, but in terms of America's popular music in the early up until like 1950s, late 40s, early 50s, America's popular music was jazz music, and And the evolution of jazz dance and jazz music are happening at the exact same time, and they were learning from each other. And so it wasn't uncommon that part of the performance was that you would also have dancers involved, right? Lindy mm-hmm. Hoppers toured with these bands, tap dancers toured with these bands. You know, that is essentially the entire way that the Cotton Club functioned, was that you had these floor shows with, you know, accompanying bands. And so, so Bunny Briggs toured with Duke for a long time. And he's not unique in that. It just so happens he was with one of the most famous bands, you know.
Right, of course.
The most famous tap dancers. But that actual relationship is quite common.
Right. And I'm not surprised that Duke pulled out one of the best dancers. You know, he would have attracted that. You know.
Well, because tap dancers are essentially jazz musicians who are working with their bodies.
Right.
They interpret, and they're based in rhythm and syncopation. And, you know, Bunny Briggs is so very musical that it makes complete sense that he would be the one because of his ability to interpret. There's a story that I tell often when I'm lecturing about jazz dance and jazz music, which is about how Duke Ellington has this quote where he said he always made room for his, or it's a Robert O'Mealy quote, but he talks about Duke Ellington as having often made room for his co-signers. And when he wrote this song that many people know as Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, it's also known as Concerto for Cootie. And it's because he wrote this song for Cootie Williams, because he knew specifically what Cootie Williams would do to this song. He didn't write Concerto for Trumpet, meaning anyone could play this song. It was specifically in mind, stylistically, with what Cootie was going to add on top of that when it was his time to interpret in solo. And that's what tap dancers do. They interpret in solo, right? Or they do it in a collective. And so not having been in the room, I would guess that Duke Ellington saw Bunny Briggs as being another contributing musician to the ensemble.
Right, right. That's fascinating. I did not know that. I want to, a little bit from that period in the 40s, when Hirschfeld did his book, Harlem as Seen by Hirschfeld, not surprisingly, there's a number of dance images in that. There is the Lindy Hop, but the two that you chose for the show were Stomping at the Savoy and Slow Blues. And I was wondering if you could talk about why you chose those two pieces.
Sure. I love, so like this, first of all, the Savoy Ballroom is a legendary hub for all things that were great in terms of swing music and Lindy Hopping. And the greatest dancing happened within the walls of that building. And it's really tragic that it was completely torn down. Mm. It's shocking to me when I think, like, when I think about it, if I really have to think about it, like, why would you tear that building?
Yeah, right.
But I think
it's the same thing about Penn Station.
Right, right. You know, the history that building held for the, I don't know, 20 something years that it was in operation, it's magical. And also, like, the way that, because it was happening, you know, its heyday was between the 20s and the 40s, all the pictures are black and white. And so, and the way that the dancers talk about the architecture of it, you're like, I'm always just dying to see color pictures of
I bet
what the space looked like. The Stomping at the Savoy, because I'm a jazz dance historian first and foremost, there was no way I wasn't going to include that one.
Right.
And it captures sort of the volume of people, and also I think it captures the thing of it as both an artistic and a social environment. And I think these are things that are also embedded into, you know, the roots of jazz dance and all of the things that we were able to maintain coming out of West African traditions. And so this idea that there's this fluid exchange between who's the watcher and who's the doer. And and then going back to that idea of dignity, that they're all dressed up in their best clothes to go out on whatever night of the week that they were, you know, doing this. So yeah, it's just, you know, him having captured that is, it's that era and that particular landmark is really significant to jazz history in general and American history, because
yes,
music is was America's music, and frankly would not have happened in the way that it did if it didn't involve the transatlantic slave trade. So, and the other picture, the other image, the Slow Blues, it captures an intimacy that is really interesting to me. I was really kind of fascinated with the different faces and different expressions and the how close or far apart dancers were to each other. And I mean, I think that could have happened at the Savoy. It also could have happened at some after hours, club, speakeasy club, where the all the musicians would go after they did the big gig. They would go to some other place,
Sure.
and this era for jazz music was meant specific. It was strategic and purposely about dancing.
Right.
Swing music, whether it's at an up tempo or a down tempo, is dance music. And so, and within that, you see some of the amazing, feats of acrobatics and rhythm. And sometimes you can get something really quiet. Maybe it's Lionel Hampton playing a ballad, and it's just two people dancing together. And I appreciated how that was captured in the image, and also the image itself in that slow blues. Has a sepia kind of quality to it, even though it's a caricature in
Right.
terms of colors that are used in that one. And that was really interesting to me too, the brownness and the rustness of it, as opposed to the black and white depiction, which feels, I know it's of that other era of those Harlem images, and when they use color in a way that he doesn't use in the later black and white line drawings. But I was really drawn to that.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, it could have been an after-hour show. He was a very serious jazz fan and dance fan. I mean, we know he went up to Harlem. I one time asked him about Harlem, and he was telling me about going up there. And when I asked about the Cotton Club, he said to me, "Oh, that was for tourists."
Right.
He didn't see it as a place that you went if you really wanted to see music and dance, you know.
Well, right, because something like the Cotton Club was specifically designed for white audiences, and there's a that I think that's a whole other podcast, but there's a whole there's a lot of sort of interrogation you can do around art that black artists are putting in front of white audiences, and how that and what's in that art versus art that was being by black people that was being put in front of other black people, and how that changes context, and it also changes content. So he's absolutely right in that even though there was great artistry happening at the Cotton Club, as my friends in hip hop would say, it wasn't for the heads. It's not where the heads go,
Yeah, no, it's
and
maybe
frankly wouldn't have been allowed because of the way that the segregating of audiences worked. So
sure. Well, I'm going to shift gears entirely because I want to ask about one of the more recent drawings in the show, and a woman who I think is extraordinary on many levels, Judith Jameson.
I was born in 72, and so there isn't a time in my life where I didn't understand the magic of as a dancer, there wasn't a time in my life I didn't understand the magic of Ailey and the Judith Jamison plays in that. And what I enjoyed about that particular drawing was how it captured her length. She's a very, very tall woman, and with that comes this sense of like real, like you feel like you're in the presence of royalty. And that particular image comes after Ailey's death, and so Judith Jamison was his muse for some time, and then she left to go explore other opportunities after she had a great deal of success with the company, and it always maintained a relationship with the company, but she wanted to go try other things. This is what artists do. And so she went off and she did Broadway. She was in Sophisticated Ladies, and she was doing some guest work with ballet companies, and she was making her own choreography. At a point in the 80s, Alvin Ailey, like so many people, became HIV positive. And it was his wish that after his death that she would succeed him as being the artistic director. And so that image it captures 10 years into her having assumed that role with the company. My understanding of that piece is she was exploring her own history in terms of being a black dancer in America and her experiences with sort of the community and lineage and root space training that she had as a Black dancer with other Black dancers, and also her experience as a Black dancer in white spaces. And so this image depicts her and some of the cast members, and there's this, they're close but also apart because she's assumed this role. So you see the hierarchy in the image?
Right.
Which I really appreciated. And also it just, you know, I think there's certain faces that probably are just great for caricature. They're so distinct, and certain faces and bodies in the case of drawing dancers. And, you know, she's got all that length and she's got those great cheekbones. And I think that's what Herschel captures. So.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because he did do an individual portrait of her in 1978 when she was in a show called The Only Game in Town. And he presented her arm raised. She was one long line. You know, and those high cheekbones are right there. It's like everything you described is in this other drawing, and it's obviously that's how he saw her.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's
who she was.
I actually have a poster, an Ailey poster, to my left in my apartment that has her on stage, and vintage poster from the 70s. And I mean, yeah, everyone sees her as this, you know, statuesque, you know, but if the thing of it is that within all of that length, there is always this elegance and this power. So there's not, she's not what you would call lanky, right? The reason that I'm using the word statuesque versus like lanky.
right. No, she seems like a real force of nature. Every photo I've seen of her and, you know, Cry and the dances that she did, that she really was the muse and the iconic figure of the Ailey Company, even when she wasn't leading it.
You know, there are, Ailey operates as a family. And so there's this, you know, legacy of amazing women. You know, Ailey came out of a matriarchal home. And so I think he always had a great esteem and reverence and inspiration from women. You know, the piece you mentioned, Cry, that was Judith Jamison's signature solo, was dedicated to Black women everywhere, you know, and particularly mothers and his mother.
Right.
So,
He brought his mother, I think, to the opening of that.
Yeah. And so, certainly, Jamison is the most well known, but it's interesting the way that company functions, particularly in dance, because dance is dominated by male leadership, and so it's no accident that he wanted her to succeed him.
Yeah.
After his death. You know, and I think it says something about how communities function, how Black communities function, how Black families function, and her leadership of the company after his death was extraordinary. You know, at a time when I think it was very hard for legacy companies to maintain artistic and financial health, Ailey has done extraordinarily well. You know, and peer companies of the same stature, not all of them survived, or they may still be in existence, but they're not operating at the capacity that they used to after their leaders died, you know.
And right.
So I think there's something to be said about, it's sort of a fascination with mine about what successive leadership looks like. And I think there's something to be looked at there in terms of what that model became after his death, and how, you know, they function as a company on a level that I don't know that any company could ever replicate, you know, in terms of what they've been able to do, like the entity that they are, you know. And now she's since stepped out of that role and is now in an emeritus role, and Robert Battle is now leading the company. But the foundation she laid from the foundation that Ailey laid is really just amazing. And a death is a crisis, you know.
Right, without a doubt.
And there's a lot of uncertainty that you're walking into, and what can we take from the people who figured it out?
Well, that is what I think is so amazing about the show that you put together, is there are so many individuals like this. I mean, one of the people we didn't talk about is Catherine Dunham, who was so committed to not only taking dance forward, but making sure that we understood where it came from.
What's interesting about that particular image, if I can just quickly say, is that was one of the only images that I was familiar with.
Mm.
that's actually a really famous Katharine Dunham image.
Sure.
And it was on a poster for a really one of her, you know, great shows. And so it, that when you look at like the history of Katharine Dunham, that image shows up quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so that was really interesting to me because I don't think I knew that it was Hirschfeld, in part because that's not in my mind. It's not what I thought Hirschfeld drawings were.
Exactly.
You know, I thought that they were, I just thought line, like these line drawings. And so I was like, oh yeah, this one I know. maybe that's the place I should start from, which is like the things that I recognize, the things that I know, and what's going to complement those things. And also, I think not dissimilar from the Josephine Baker discussion, you know, she's you know, depicted as this sort of saucy, sassy Black lady as well. And, sure. And Katharine Dunham was a woman of many, 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 many layers, an anthropologist, a choreographer, an educator, an activist, and sure. Had this long and varied and critical career to the way that Black dance functions. And so it was really kind of a treat to encounter that image as I was sorting through all of the ones. I guess the last thing I just kind of want to say in regards to all of those images is one of the harder things about the exhibit for me, and it required me to do a lot of research, was really figuring out what to do with caricature in America for Black artists. And it was hard, and I had some conflict about how to approach this and if I was even the right one to be doing this. And ultimately I decided that, you know, that there was something that I wanted to say about these images and putting them together. But I think looking at the depiction of Black artists by white artists is fraught. And sure. Caricature in particular, because of the way it accentuates specific features, in the wrong hands can very easily fall over into those minstrel caricatures. And I had to navigate some images that I was not comfortable with.
Understood. I mean, even as a white person looking at them, you know, I understand the world that he created them in, but that doesn't make them any more acceptable now, or really, I would think even acceptable then, but that was what society accepted.
You know, for me, it's about context, because again, as a jazz historian, I often have to encounter a lot of work from the early 20th century that the context of where it's situated is problematic, mm-hmm. but the artistry that it depicts is
right.
extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And ultimately my approach to the exhibit was I'm always on the side of these artists.
Yes. And
anything that I can do that places them in their rightful esteem during the eras when they maybe didn't get it, that's the work that I want to do.
Right.
And so I hope that as people, particularly Black people, encounter this exhibit, that's something that is coming through in the information that I shared with the images and the images themselves that I selected.
Yeah, and that's really what this show is not about Hirschfeld. It's about the dancers. And that's really what we wanted to focus on. People know Hirschfeld and they have their own opinion. But I think, and for people who think they know all of Hirschfeld's work, it's these images, they think, oh, I never saw this one before, because they, you know, those aren't the ones selected. If, you know, when they select a dancer, if a publication selects a Hirschfeld drawing of a dancer, it's a stare, it's Baryshnikov, it's Gene Kelly, because I'm sure there's a variety of reasons. The fact that they were white is a big one, but it's also the ones that people know. So it's a great pleasure of ours to be able to shine the spotlight on so many of these dancers, you know, figures like Bunny Briggs and Honey Coles. You know, I love hearing about them. They're fascinating dancers.
I think and then there were others that I could have selected, but I just felt like, oh, it's taking me in terms of like a story that I, you know, or collection, right. It's taking me in a direction I didn't want to, that I felt like, oh, this is going to confuse some of the narrative that I'm creating here, but I think You know, the image to me that kind of captures what I'm trying to say is the Sammy Davis image, actually.
Oh,
All of the Sammy.
stop the world, I want to get off.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, and that's like later, you know.
Yeah, 78, yeah.
You know. But the all of the depictions of the Sammies, and the different expressions and the complexity of that as a, you know, like, because like the performance, it happened, it's done, there's a recording of it, I've never seen it. But to being left with this image of this person who's so three-dimensional and the portrayal of who he was on stage, because having seen Sammy so many times, I mean, Sammy is like best of the best. I keep calling everyone the best of the best. There can be many best.
The pantheon.
But specifically, there's so many different depictions of him in that one image, and the complexity of that brings a humanity and a dignity to who he was as a performer, you know,
Sure.
that I think is really important to how we frame the artistic contributions of these artists, looking back on the work that they did in the 20th century. It's not enough to say, oh, here's someone who overcame racism and became famous. That is absolutely 100% true.
True.
Also, like, let's look at the complexity of their art, you know,
Right.
at the thing that Sammy could do. That's what's great about those tap dancers. They're all so very singular. And so
Right.
the thing that Honey Coles can do is not the things that Bunny Briggs does. They're
Right.
distinctly different. And same with Sammy, because Sammy was also, among many things, a tap dancer. And so the
Sure.
way that Sammy tap danced was not the way Charlie Atkins tap danced, you know. And the richness of that palette and of those contributions informs me as an artist every single day that I do my work.
Well, I think that's really what you captured in the exhibition, and we're so grateful that you took the time to go through hundreds of images, if not thousands of images, to select these pieces. I think anybody who has an interest in any aspect of dance, of Black history, of Hirschfeld, has a reason to check out this exhibition. It opens February 1st, and we hope that everyone gets a chance to come see it and let us know what you think. Well, Melanie, is there anything that you wanted to say that you didn't get a chance to say, or?
Part of the reason that I accepted the invitation to curate this was to be captured by Hirschfeld puts these artists in a sort of rare camp of people of artists in you know in the US and I think that's important, particularly in looking at the like the Nicholas Brothers story and how
Right.
we frame it around the ceiling of their career. And so I think it's important to note that being captured by Hirschfeld also is another sort of indicator of success that was achieved.
Right.
Like I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to
No,
put my
it was a
words.
sign that you had achieved the kind of fame, celebrity, respect that a newspaper artist of that time could capture you. And remember, people who saw that Nicholas Brothers drawing opened up their paper and saw it.
Yeah.
And right away, you sort of get what it's all about. You read the caption and you say, Nicholas Brothers. He's telling you a great deal about the Nicholas Brothers, and in some ways he helped with their immortality. We're here; it is 90 years later, and we're still talking about the Nicholas Brothers, and and from that drawing. So,
I guess what I'm trying to say too, though, is that it's overly simplifies to talk about these artists as being on the margins. And certainly, barriers to access of systemic racism in this country does situate them within the margins of what was considered successful by their peer white artists. But the reality is, when the art was being made, they were firmly in the center of the page, right? You know, whether or not that's the way that history decides to catalog the work.
Right.
These depictions to me are indicators of not only the achievement, but the actuality of what was happening in the moment. Like that Nicholas Brothers image, I went back and read this chapter of this, one of the sort of most well-known jazz history books is by Marshall Stearns, and he catalogs the history of vernacular dance and up through like the mid 20th century. And the Nicholas Brothers talk about that particular production, and they say, and the way that it gets written about is in most books is that, you know, this is a George Balanchine production, and if I hadn't had a 150 character limit, I would have gone on about the way that this thing actually functions, which is that one of the Nicholas Brothers says, Balanchine watched us dance and play around and be in rehearsal together. And for that section, he didn't show us anything. He just told us. And so they're actually the choreographers of their own number.
Wow.
It's not the way it gets written.
Right, right. No, of course.
You know,
have you ever seen any film? There's, you know, there's a home movie taken of a scene from that show.
Right.
Where, you know, where, you know, they're jumping over each other. And I mean, it's amazing.
And it completely stands to reason. And so again, thinking about, well, what does it mean to be on the margins when you're the one who actually made your own work? You know, maybe you didn't get credit for it. So looking at how to reframe the actuality of what was happening in the real rehearsal rooms, what was truly happening on the stage, and not the way that in books it's easy to be reductive,
right,
that there was a dancer and there was a choreographer and there was racism in the end, you know.
Right.
But it's more complicated than that, and these artists are way more embedded into the center of the page than history would let us think.
Sure.
I think that's my last
thing. No, that's perfect, and I think that's what you did a great job in the show of doing that. So thank you very much, and thank you for your time today on the podcast. We really appreciate it. Everybody go to melaniegeorge.org and learn all the things that she is doing, because you won't believe it. It's like this whole show, except with many other aspects of it. Thank you, Melanie. Thanks everybody for listening.